Next case is SO Standard Oil. I guess everyone didn't change to Exxon. This is the United States, 2008, Prop 12, Prop 34. Here from Mr. Knauss, is it?
Knauss. May it please the court, my name is Curtis Knauss. I'm counsel for the plaintiff appellant in this action, SO Standard Oil Company in Puerto Rico. This case centers on Customs' illegal exaction of HMT payments on shipments between insular possessions and Customs' further refusal to refund these illegal exactions. There's no disagreement that the payments at issue were contrary to the amended HMT statute. What remains at issue, however, is means by which SO should be repaid these illegal exactions.
There are really two categories here, and you're arguing the one that was held not to have been filed for within a year, right?
And that is correct.
And it's cross appeal on the other two.
That's correct, Your Honor. So the issue before the court today is whether and how to refund these illegal exactions. I will present four viable means for SO to do just that. First, Customs Headquarters Telex in 1989.
Well, we're not starting from scratch, right? The trial court wasn't filed for within a year. Isn't that the only issue in your appeal?
No, that's not exactly the issue that we've raised, Your Honor. That's the issue that the government has cross-appealed on. SO prevailed on, as you mentioned, the two protests that the court found were refundable under 520C. SO's...
What's the inadvertence? What is the inadvertence that the trial court seized upon to allow you a year rather than the 90-day cutoff?
Well, the court found it inconceivable that Customs could fail to implement the 1988 amendments to the HMT statute.
Don't and you have some obligation to ensure that you're paying the correct amounts and that you're assessed correctly?
Absolutely. But that's what the trial court held. But what SO is arguing today is that the mistake of fact was that neither Customs nor the importer knew that these import shipments were free of HMT tax assessment. And further, neither Customs nor the importer knew the procedures and requirements to process such a claim.
Don't you have some obligation, is my question, to make sure that the law is being correctly applied to you?
Under the Customs Mod Act, yes, importers have to take reasonable care in their importations. But if, and this goes for our equitable issue, which is, did Customs mislead the importing public? And in this case, they certainly did. But back to the telex and the amendments of 1988 in section 2002B, they provided a new cause of action outside of the protests and 520C procedures.
But the telex is not really a regulation or other official action that would give rise to a legal claim, is it?
Well, in conjunction with the 1988 amendments, I would say it is akin to a customs regulation, although there's no notice and comment.
I mean, every notification issued by a government agency gives rise to some cause of action in and of itself?
No, I wouldn't say that. But again, it was simply implementing the 1988 section 2002B amendments that the legislature approved.
Was it implemented or simply notified?
It was doing both.
But did it with adequate specificity to waive sovereign immunity, did it clarify that there would be a cause of action in the event that the refunds weren't granted properly?
There was no express grant of a new cause of action. But at the time...
Wouldn't that suggest then that the Congress expected that any mistakes would be remedied under the mistake of law provision? You'd have 90 days to bring it to the attention of the government?
I think that's exactly what that implementation does is it was published in 1988. So at that time, and at the time of the Telex publication, there were already import transactions that were outside of both the protest procedure and the 520C procedure. So I think it's really the intent of the legislature to have created a new cause of action, knowing full well that there were already transactions that were outside of those two processes. So yes, I think that what both of them do is implicitly create this new cause of action, waive sovereign immunity. Both the Telex and the amendments under Section 2002B provided for no time limit to file the refund claim. As I mentioned before, the actual date of the publication shows that prior importations had occurred. Therefore, it was meant to capture those importations outside of both the protest procedure and 520C procedure. And the Court of International Trade erred in concluding that the Telex did not apply to imports when its plain language provided for CF-7501s for imports as being subject to refunds to HMT. The second point that SO presents this morning is the refund procedure under 2424E5 is applicable to this case. It's the only refund procedure.
But you've got to have a quarterly summary report, right?
Well, that's not explicitly stated in the refund procedure, no.
But this provision applies to those who file quarterly.
It applies, SO contends that it applies to all payments of the HMT. Systematic reading of the regulation, A, describes the act itself, the B, provides the definitions, C, lists the exemptions, D, the special rules, and then E, it's all about collections.
But in context of the overall series of regulations, they seem to all apply to those who normally file quarterly.
That is correct. But there is no explicit prohibition, and there's no mention of any refund procedure outside of 2424E5. And before 2000...
This is really a procedure more for exporters, right, rather than importers?
Well, there's a number of provisions. The passengers, there's export shipments, there's FTZ shipments, so on and so forth. So subsection E of 2424 captures all the possible HMT collections, the refund procedures. So everything is right there. And as this court is well aware, before 2001, when the regulation was amended, that there was no time limit for HMT refunds under that regulation. The third point that ESSA would like to make this morning is that the denial of the claims was the first protestable decision. And the Court of International Trade erred in finding that the actual denial of the refund claim was not the first protestable decision. When Customs exacts the HMT, they're acting in a ministerial role. As this court has held in USU and others, the tax is based on the value of cargo. Congress set the amount of tax. Customs follows customs instructions, and again, simply acts in a ministerial role. The Mitsubishi case is also illustrative here, where it said customs cannot modify determinations, their underlying facts, their enforcement. It's the same situation we have here. SO timely filed protests on the refund claim denials. And again, the CIT erred by finding that the denial was not protestable. Finally, we have an equitable argument. And SO believes that we fulfill the requirements under Brockamp and Irwin in that we pursued the claim with due diligence and there was a misleading government action. At this point, I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
We will do that, Mr. Knauss.
Thank you.
Ms. Hogan. The open to defend the third claim that was held, not being filed within a year, and argue on cross appeal that the two that were held to comply with 1520 do not.
Yes, Your Honor. And with the court's permission, I will address the our cross appeal first. May it please the court. SO paid the hard maintenance tax, and Customs liquidated those entries on the assumption that the law required payment on those shipments. The law did not require payment on those shipments. This is a textbook example of a mistake of law, and the trial court erred by failing to give import to the rest of the Section 1520
C1. The trial court held that this was just an inadvertence. There was no discussion, interpretation of the law. There was no error of law. It was just an inadvertence.
Well, two points, Your Honor. First, the statute doesn't just provide relief when there is an inadvertence. As this court said in Ford Motor, the second question, assuming that there is an inadvertence, is that that inadvertence is not also a mistake of law, such as was the case.
The fact that there was an inadvertence, the categorization of this as an inadvertence, is that a finding of fact to which we owe deference?
No, well, I would say no, Your Honor, because it was a summary judgment motion. So this was
agreed
to.
Who failed to put into the software the proper provision to make sure the taxes weren't assessed?
Our position is that is the software vendor's responsibility if they choose to do so. Customs does not review the software for its legal content. It merely reviews the software to ensure that it makes the correct electronic transmissions to Customs. But even so, let's assume that the software forced SO to make this payment against their will and against the law. They still have 90 days from the date of liquidation.
Why did that happen in this? Why was the software not correct?
Your Honor, that those facts are not in the record below. That was not really addressed. And there's no...
Is it within the trial court's power to determine that that was an inadvertence? That no one deliberately excluded the proper standard of law, but instead did it out of inadvertence?
Well, Your Honor, as this court said in Century Importers, the repetition of inadvertence usually demonstrates an advertent misunderstanding of the law. This is not the case where there was one accidental thing that happened. And
was there any evidence in the record that somebody misunderstood the law?
The uncontested evidence here is that everyone misunderstood the law.
Everybody knew the law. You put out a telex. Everybody read the telex. Everybody knew the law, but it had not been applied. That's not a mistake in the interpretation of the law. That may well be an inadvertence in the application of the law, mightn't it?
But even an inadvertent application of the law is a mistake of the law, Your Honor. And it would be hard to imagine how all the parties operating under the assumption that the statute required SO to pay this, when in fact the statute did. It doesn't matter whether the reason for that was an incorrect regulation, whether the reason for that relief was an independent legal conclusion that had been drawn by either of the parties, it was in the state of law.
Can we look at one of the points Mr. Knauss made? He said the telex comes out, it announces the change of law, and it applies it retroactively to April of 87. If, in fact, somebody had made a payment in April of 87, it would already have been past the one-year time limit at the time the telex came out. So certainly the government, in making this announcement, didn't expect there to be an even one-year time limit, did it?
The customs expected that the statutes that Congress has put in place in 1520 and 1514 to be followed. The telex...
Well, wait a second. The telex gave those retroactive rights, which were then wholly unenforceable. They were wholly specious rights. Does the government offer retroactive rights that are illegal?
No, Your Honor. And
then they didn't expect even a one-year time limit. Whose mistake of law was that?
I'm not sure how to answer that, and it may have been...
I'm not sure how you answer it either, but it certainly cuts against the idea that there's a one-year time limit, doesn't it?
No, Your
Honor.
Even
a one-year time limit. It's certainly not a 90-day, which you insist on.
I think that the way to look at that is that the telex specifically refers to previously filed forms. HMT that had already been...
Fine, we'll take that. If someone had filed a request as of April of 87, it was already past, clearly past 90 days and well past a year at the time the telex comes out, right?
It's conceivable that it would have been a year past
the... So the government didn't anticipate application of those time limits either.
But that was not customs. Customs did not have the power to eviscerate the finality rules in 1514 or 1520. Only Congress has that power. And certainly here we are talking about...
Was that an inadvertence or a mistake of law?
Solely with respect to these...
Yes,
the
telex being issued with language that could not have been enforced.
Well, it could have been enforced had the liquidation not been final. There certainly would have been a body of entries whose liquidation was not final for whom they could have received a refund under 1514. But to the extent that Congress didn't anticipate there being a certain set of entries for whom the finality period was expired, that was something that Congress failed to do, not something that Customs had the power to
correct. Was Customs' mistake in putting out the telex then a mistake of law or an inadvertence?
I don't think it's either, because the telex, one, informed everyone this is the state of the new law, and if there is finality is not, if liquidations are not final, then they would be entitled to receive refund of those retroactive payments.
But Ms. Hogan, this court handed down a decision in Century Importers, extremely well stated and articulated. The trial court sort of skipped over it. How do you distinguish it?
We believe that this case is exactly on point with Century Importers. In Century Importers, the importer claimed that there was an inadvertence by failing to file a certain form that was needed to proceed duty-free treatment, and this court found that the failure to do that over and over and over again indicated not an inadvertence, but actually ignorance of the law, which is mistake of law. And it's very similar to the case in an executor. The same result was, you know, the failure to do something over and over again indicates not an inadvertence, not the failure to put something in an envelope once, as was the case in Avial, but in fact, that the importer was operating under the assumption that something was legally owed, when in fact it was not. That is a textbook mistake of law.
Trial court said this may very well be the last case in which the court must decide the excruciatingly difficult question, etc. Why is that?
In 2004, Congress rescinded 520 and or 1520, and so now all importers bring all mistakes, whether they're law, fact, inadvertence, to customs attention within 180 days. 1514A was revised. So as far as we know, there's one other case before the Court of International Trade on almost exactly identical facts. That will be the last time that...
You don't regard this as an excruciatingly difficult question?
Yes. We don't believe this is an excruciatingly difficult question in this case.
Digress for just a minute. Nobody's arguing that the tax wasn't imposed at the time. Why are we even here? Why does the government just give the money back?
Because this customs is obligated to follow what Congress has set forth as finality. If importers could come back years and years later,
and separate and apart from the niceties of these statutes and regulations, the government is in possession of monies collected when the tax wasn't on the statute, on the books.
Right. But again, that happens not frequently, but it may often be the case where an importer pays something that they're not legally obligated to pay, and if they don't bring that to the attention of customs within 90 days, then that liquidation is final, and customs can't be in the habit first of all, it doesn't have statutory authority to refund something when Congress has said it's final. And it would seriously impose on customs' ability to administrate their programs efficiently if these statutes of limitations were not strictly followed. Let me just address a few issues that were raised by ESSO's counsel. First, with respect to the regulation. First of all, ESSO has never claimed that it actually followed 2424E5. It's never claimed that it attempted to file an amended quarterly summary report form 350 and send that to customs. It didn't do that. And the reason that it didn't do that is because it didn't make quarterly payments. So there was no way that it could comply with this regulation, which indicates that this regulation did only apply to quarterly payers and not to importers. Rather, importers were still subject to the same protests and reliquidation statutes that they are always subject to, even if the tax that they are seeking refund of is the harbor maintenance tax, the 26 U.S.C. 4462. H&T is treated like a customs duty unless customs issues a regulation stating otherwise. So clearly, just the plain language of E5 demonstrates that it does not apply to importers. Second, the denial of ESSO's request for liquidation was not its first protestable decision. Liquidation was. That's simply by statute, and there can be no question that liquidation gave them the opportunity to protest. Finally, with respect to their equitable argument, first of all, ESSO did not raise this in its opening brief, and we did not adequately address this issue in our brief because it was not raised. But assuming that 1514 or 1520C could be equitably told, and this court has never held that it can be equitably told, in Juice Farms, this court assumed but never decided. But even assuming that it could be, it's very clear that ignorance of the law is not a basis to toll a statute of limitations. That is beyond dispute. This court has no other questions. I'll save my
rebuttal. We'll save the remainder of the time for rebuttal on the cross-appeal issue.
Mr. Knaus, once you've gotten notice through the telex and indeed by the passage of the statute, why isn't it just fair to impose the time limit on you that is imposed on every other importer, 90 days from liquidation? You've had your notice. You've got 90 days from liquidation.
Well, as this court held in the Mitsubishi...
It's fair for every other importer. Why isn't it fair for you?
Well, because of the mistakes of fact that we mentioned earlier.
What's the mistake of fact?
The customs and the importer, neither one knew that these shipments were exempt from the HMT payment. Further, neither party knew the process.
I'm sure that every importer would like to say we didn't really realize that we had to pay all these duties, but they still get just 90 days. We don't like to pay all these duties. Whatever their argument is, they get 90 days.
Well, again, 90 days from a customs decision.
Yeah, liquidation.
That's right.
That's not contested. That's the law.
It is the law. And this court has held in Mitsubishi that just because there's a liquidation doesn't mean that that's sufficient to arise to a customs decision. So in that case, it was saying the dumping duties that were applied. They were liquidated. It was an importer. Same set of facts here. Customs did not make a decision in liquidation. They simply followed Congress's intent, which is to take an ad valorem tax on the value of the cargo. They didn't determine classification or valuation. They did none of those things that are usually attached to a customs decision or liquidation. So just because the government customs says, hey, well, it went through liquidation, therefore you're subject to the protest process, really neglects this court's precedent, which is customs has to make a decision. They did not do that in this case.
Speaking of this court's precedent, how do you distinguish Century?
Well, Century came up under a different set of facts. Again, in this case, there was no decision on liquidation. So there was no protestable decision upon liquidation. So there was no way, there was nothing for the importer to protest. And the first time that there was a protestable decision, that was when Customs denied their refund claim, which I might add Customs mistakenly characterized as a 1520C claim, which it wasn't. It was simply a refund claim pursuant to Section 2002B.
At liquidation, do you receive some kind of notice of exactly what you're paying, you know, a line item of how much is tax and harbor tax and so forth?
You get, yes, there's a receipt of all those things, yes.
Then at that point, you had notice you were paying harbor tax, you had 90 days, right?
Same thing as Mitsubishi. They were assessing the dumping duties at that time. They knew what all the payments were.
You knew the law. You knew what you'd been assessed. All you have to do is add and subtract at that point, right?
That's all. You just have to check off to see that's what they paid. That's what the importer does. There's absolutely no decision. This, in getting to the government's cross appeal, this is exactly the type of factual situation the 520C was developed for. As this court referred to in its CJ Tower case, although there's no direct legislative history, it looked for the prior act's legislative history. And to Justice Lynn's point, testimony on the record in legislative history says, the government has no interest in retaining duties which were improperly collected as a result of clerical error, mistake of fact, or inadvertence. The inability to make refunds in such cases results in great dissatisfaction and a feeling of justice among importers. And that's what we're really here for. It's like that Customs failed to implement this act of Congress and really has no rights nor interest in retaining these illegally exacted HMT payments.
What if there was a regulation that a customs agent was following in implementing and imposing a duty, and the regulation was simply inconsistent with the statute and hadn't been changed? In other words, a straight regulation as opposed to the software in question here. And the duty was paid and not protested. Would that would be a clear error of law, right? The facts are not in dispute.
That's exactly the
The legal consequences are not fully appreciated.
And that's what the government's arguing, and that's why this court has wrestled, as other courts have, with mistake of fact versus mistake of law. That's really customs blaming the victim here, saying, hey, you know, the importer should have known that we didn't implement the direction of Congress.
And but that would be the same in my hypothetical, huh?
It is.
Why is the outcome different here?
Well, again, because...
that would clearly be a question, an error of law.
That would be, but that's not the mistake here. The mistake is that neither Customs nor the importer knew that these shipments were exempt from that HMT payment at the time of import, which is exactly on all fours with...
Well, Customs knew what the law was.
Well, that's unclear.
Well, presumptively.
Correct. Correct.
And same thing for the importer, presumptively.
And that's what makes it more abhorrent, that they want to keep those taxes if they knew that they were illegal.
And this just would be the same in my hypothetical. Presumptively, both Customs and the importer knew what the law was, and presumptively they knew the regulation was out of date, was ineffective, but nonetheless it was applied. That's an error of law.
That would be an error of law. We're not here in this case. Where we are is that there were mistakes of fact made by both Customs and the importer on what shipments were exempt from HMT.
I mean, ignorance of the law doesn't make any difference.
No, it does not.
I'm still having trouble as to the difference between my hypothetical and what we're dealing
with. Well, I don't think there's any, again, there's been no misconstruing of the law in terms of, it's not like a classification case where...
a tax was imposed when a tax shouldn't have been imposed.
Exactly, and that's...
Not
it's,
because of any mistake, somebody didn't fill out the wrong... form. The form was filled out in accordance with the software, which hadn't been properly updated.
That's right. And by the way, that software was okayed by Customs. But this case is on all fours with both CJ Tower and GNR Produce. When you look at the CJ Tower facts, it's the same thing as you were that you were questioning, and that is neither Customs nor the importer in that case knew that the aircraft parts were subject to the emergency war materials provision, which is a different part of the tariff schedule. So neither one knew. I mean, the law seemingly was clear. If you could go back, everybody could sit down and say, hey, here's the law, and no one disagreed that in retrospect that it was amenable to the emergency war materials. So in that case and in this case, this court should find that it was a mistake of fact.
Thank you, Mr. Knauss.
Thank you.
Ms. Hoagland will give you your full 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Maybe it would help to go back just as the way this works. The importer files an entry at the time merchandise comes into the country. It makes the initial decision which taxes and which fees are owed. And under statute, it's required to use reasonable care in determining what that is. Customs liquidates the entry. It may actually physically look at the entry. It may bypass it, and because it can't look at every single entry. Either way, at liquidation, all legal decisions of Customs, whether explicit or implicit, are embodied in that liquidation. That's 19 U.S.C. 1514A. There can be no question that that was the point at which Customs had made a legal determination that the agency was owed, and that triggered the 90-day statute of limitations to file a protest. And in fact, in ESSO's response brief, it provides the court with some examples of where Customs actually looked at the entries and said, hey, you owe more HMT than we thought initially. So there is at least some indication that in some cases, Customs did in fact look at it and make a determination that HMT was owed. But even if it hadn't, the liquidation...
If they had just put the decimal point in the wrong place and somehow, by a factor of 10, increased their duty, that would be an inadvertence, right?
If, or Claire Blair, yes.
And Claire Blair, so that would be, why isn't this very similar to that? Why isn't this closer to that than someone mistakenly interpreting the law incorrectly?
Because this is the party operating under the assumption that the agency was owed over and over and over and over again. And if ESSO's argument is that it delegated its duty to determine what its legal obligations were to a software program, that does not excuse it from meeting the 90-day protest period. It still had an obligation to use reasonable care to check and say, hey, the statute conflicts with the regulation, and the statute is beneficial to me. I think that I will bring this to Customs' attention that they've been doing this wrong.
But isn't that exactly the same as Judge Rader's hypothetical? With the decimal point shifted?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because if it was a case of a decimal point being shifted once, there could be, and depending on the facts, of course, there could be an argument that was just simply a clerical error.
Well, I understood his hypothetical. Maybe I misunderstood. But I understood it wasn't just shifted once, but it was in the software that was wrong. And it was charged over and over and over and over again. People were charged 10 times what they owed over and over and over again.
And again, Your Honor, I think we would have to look at the facts, but the importer is ultimately responsible for ensuring that it's calculated its legal obligations correctly. And if it were mistakenly believing that it owed a 10% tax instead of a 1% tax over and over and over again, that might give rise to an argument that
it's an error of law,
depending on the facts. But here, you know, there could be no dispute. ESSO says explicitly, we were unaware until 1997 that the statute did not require us to pay it. That's a mistake of law.
Do you have one final quick point, Ms. Holden?
No, Your Honor. I think we'll rest on the briefs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case will be taken under advisement.